On the 25th of June 1905, two raffish millionaires in New York prepared to spend rather similar evenings on the town. Both went to Rector's restaurant on Times Square before going on to the theatre. Rector's had a discreetly disreputable reputation. While great actresses patronised the place after Broadway performances, it was also a hangout for upmarket courtesans who identified themselves by wearing décolleté gowns. Rector's offered private rooms in addition to its main dining room, and as Mr. and Mrs. Harry Thaw seated themselves for friends for dinner, Evelyn Thaw spotted architect Stanford White and a small party emerging from one of the private rooms. She quickly passed her husband Harry a note reading, "The bee is here," as he'd ordered her to do whenever she saw Stanford White. There was a reason for this. Evelyn had been White's mistress before she married Thaw, and Thaw was both fascinated and enraged by this. He had in some way used it to justify some of his own sadistic assaults on his wife, and he insisted that Thaw was only to be described as the beast, the bastard, or the bee. Thaw stiffened, then relaxed, patted his wife's hand and said, "Yes, dear, I know he's here. I saw him. Thank you for telling." White was in the middle of a varied evening's entertainment. He had taken his son Lawrence and one of his Harvard friends to dinner at another expensive but dubious restaurant, Martin's Cafe, between Broadway and Fifth Avenue, where risque illustrated Parisian magazines were stocked for the delectation of diners, and an upper foyer accommodated unaccompanied ladies who hoped to be invited to impromptu parties in the private rooms. The three had not sampled the upstairs wares after eating, but went on to the New Amsterdam Aerial Roof Garden, where Lawrence White and his friend wanted to see the George M. Cohan play The Governor's Son. White declined to join them, and history does not relate exactly who accompanied him to the private room in Rector's and what went on behind its closed doors. So we may hope for the worst. It was not until 10:55... that Stanford White arrived at the Madison Square Roof Garden, where the new musical Mamselle Champagne was opening. The Thaws had been there throughout the performance. Harry had seated himself beside Stanford White's brother-in-law, James Clinch Smith, and engaged him in animated conversation on the stock market, the companionship of pretty girls, ocean liner travel, and even the play they were supposed to be watching. Throughout the chatter, Thaw kept turning to a prominent table in front of the stage, reserved for Stanford White, who, as the building's designer and occupant of the best apartment in its tower, had his own place as and when he wanted it. He wanted it this evening, as the manager well knew, in order to cultivate the acquaintance of a new young lady in the chorus who was to be introduced to him at the show's end. But his interest in her did not extend to making him watch the entire play. Stanford White only appeared toward the end of the final act. Thaw rose from his place and drew the attention of several diners by pacing ashen-faced up and down the aisles. Every so often he glanced at White. Once he went out into the lobby where the elevators were, shepherding away Evelyn and her party, she having indicated that she did not want to stay after White's arrival. Then, muttering to himself so that several people thought he was drunk, Thaw made his way back to White and stood over him. "Yes, Thaw, what is it?" asked Stanford White. In answer, Thaw shot him three times. Two bullets entered his shoulder, the third penetrated his head and killed him. Stanford White slumped onto his table, knocking a glass over, before his body fell to the floor and lay there in the steadily growing pool of his blood. Thaw looked at him and said with a curse, "You'll never go out with that woman again." The singer on stage froze in the middle of his song, "I Could Love a Million Girls." The audience froze, some thinking that this was a new instance of putting actors in the auditorium for novelty effect. Then Harry Thor slowly lifted up his pistol and let it droop in the air as if to show that he intended no harm to anyone else, before he walked firmly to the elevator lobby. Women screamed and demanded that their escorts take them away. A rush for the door started. The manager leapt onto a table and demanded that the show go on and the chorus be brought in. The band attempted to get their tune going raggedly, and the frightened chorus girls went half-heartedly through their paces, peering anxiously into the audience to see what new threat awaited them. Out in the lobby, a fireman quietly took Thor's pistol away. The murderer made no resistance. A policeman, who'd been on duty at the main door, rushed in and arrested Thor. Constable Deebs had carefully asked the management whether there was any shooting in the play, as only the previous week he had caused an accidental disturbance at another theatre when he rushed in to investigate pistol shots, only to find that they were ordinary blanks fired on the stage as part of the performance. This time he was right to think he was wanted. Thor came quietly, making a remark to the policeman which Deebs did not catch perfectly. Probably, he said, he deserved it. I can prove it. He ruined my wife and then deserted the girl. Only Deebs wasn't sure that he hadn't said life rather than wife. Before the officer and his charge could get into the elevator, Evelyn hurried forward, pale and shocked. She kissed her husband, saying, "My God, Harry, what have you done?" Thor suggested that he'd probably saved her life, to which she responded, "I never thought you'd do it this way." At the police station, Thor gave his name as John Smith, occupation student. He chain-smoked cigarettes. He asked for a leading lawyer, though stipulating that the man need not be called till the morning and shouldn't be woken up. He refused to explain his actions, and he had no comment to offer when his visiting cards in the name Harry K. Thor were found in his pocket. Harry Thor's mother announced that she would spend $1 million to secure her son's freedom. And in the first instance, she engaged California lawyer Delphin Delmas, whose record included 19 murder defences with 19 murder acquittals. Delmas advised Mrs. Thor that her son had obviously murdered a defenceless man in full view of the public. It was therefore unlikely that he could secure complete acquittal, but he anticipated escaping the death sentence. On the other side, aggressive District Attorney William Travers Jerome made the usual aggressive noises to the press about securing a conviction and not letting anyone's money stand in the way of the people of New York securing justice against a murderer. But in private, Jerome was known to doubt Thor's sanity and to feel very unhappy about seeking the capital penalty for a man he suspected might not be fit to stand trial. He had no alternative, however. Mrs. William Thor would not let her son plea bargain an insanity or manslaughter compromise. The newspapers had a field day. For Delmas hired press agent Ben Atwell to create sympathy for Thor by blackening Stanford White's character well before the case came to trial. Sensational stories of the goings-on in his Madison Gardens Tower apartment appeared in the tabloids. It seemed Mr. White liked his chicks young. Susan Johnson was another like Evelyn Thor, née Nesbitt, who had visited him when she was only 15. Had found herself plied with champagne and seduced. Then, having had his wicked way of her, the cruel bounder twirled his moustaches and abandoned her to drag her shame through the gutters, penniless and deserted. Oh, the sighing violins, the choruses of "It's the same the whole world over" that could be imagined backing up that tale. And if Susan Johnson supported Evelyn's stories of the quality of White's lovemaking, name after name was adduced to build up the quantity. Sometimes it seemed that half the female population of New York had dressed itself in childish clothes, swung on the red velvet swing in the apartment, and let wicked Mr. White enjoy a lustful peep at their knickers before he got down to the real business of tearing them off and enjoying what he found inside them. But the prosecution was not to be outdone. Jerome discovered that one Ethel Thomas had tried to bring charges against Thor in 1902, a busy period of his love life, 3 years before his marriage, when Thor took Evelyn on a trip to Europe, where, according to an affidavit she swore out against him on her return, he beat her repeatedly and declared his intention of ruining Stanford White. Ethel said that Thor had plied her with flowers, jewels, clothes, and tender expressions of affection and respect. Lulled by this gentlemanly wooing, she agreed to meet him and go to his apartment, and wondered why he stopped on the way to buy a dog whip. "What's that for?" she asked innocently. "That's for you, dear," was Thor's laughing reply. But it was no joke when they entered his rooms, and Thor seized the whip and beat her so savagely that his blows stripped her clothes from her in tatters. "Are you surprised to learn that Ethel reported a wild expression in his eyes?" The murder case came to court in January 1907. Evelyn stood by her husband. With Delmas's enthusiastic approval, she was dressed very simply in a plain navy skirt with shirt-waister blouse. Had the skirt been calf rather than ankle length, she would have been a schoolgirl in appearance. Her hat was a plain black velvet, trimmed with violets, and the wonderful contrast between her demurely innocent appearance and the raunchy experiences she related with timid bashfulness made her appearance instant fashion. Every black hat trimmed with violets in New York was sold before the trial was out. Evelyn gave the fullest account of the wickedness of Stanford White, velvet swing, drugged champagne and all. She did it so well, and Mr. Delmas built it up so luridly in his final speech, that almost everybody overlooked the successful introduction of a prosecution expert witness who testified that any known drug capable of rendering Evelyn helpless with the speed she claimed would certainly have killed her. It also suited the defence tactics that Evelyn should make the most of her husband's ferocious rages, the brutality of his treatment of her, until she had fully confessed his uncontrollable anger against the beast, the bastard, the bee. Indeed, at times, Mr. Jerome's cross-examination invited answers so deeply embarrassing to her that she was permitted to whisper her replies to the prosecutor under cover of her modestly gloved hand. Jerome, in turn, passed them on in an undertone to the court stenographer, who quickly had typed copies made up for the judge and jury. It is so extraordinary a procedure that it leads me to wonder whether Evelyn was confessing that in calling Mr. White the bee, Harry Thor was angrily drawing attention to an alleged appetite for anal intercourse on the great seducer's part. It would at least represent a perversion that was not included in Thor's own extensive repertoire, and that abbreviation of bugger was quite common in educated British Edwardian circles. My only doubt is that the word bugger, a corruption of bulgar after the Bulgarians became infiltrated with the Cathar heresy, whose Catholic enemies, with the typical dirty-mindedness of Orthodox anti-heretics, accused them of emulating the cities of the plain, the word bugger has lost all its sodomitical force in most parts of America and just means fellow or boy. But in any case, we can all enjoy a good shiver at the fact that Evelyn Thor revealed things so dreadful at her husband's first murder trial that they were never allowed into the cold light of day. And we can all protest that justice has not been seen to be done because we haven't all learnt the full, exquisitely dirty details. Mr. Delmas was perfectly happy for all this to come out. He was trying a most extraordinary defence. Mixing a hint of insanity with a daring hint of the unwritten law. New York does not rest upon the Code Napoleon, and so crime passionnel is not recognised. Still, there can be few juries anywhere that would not feel some sympathy for a legitimately armed husband who, arriving home unexpectedly to find his wife in bed with a stranger, shoots one or both of them on the spot. And by extension, well, Shouldn't you be allowed to kill the adulterous profaner of your bed a little later? Or such an outrageous bounder as Stanford White at any time at all? There were certainly those who believed that Thor had rendered the city a great service after they read Ben Atwell's lurid account of the procession of ladies defiled in Madison Garden's tower. Now, Mr. Delmas couldn't openly argue that the unwritten law allowed Harry Thor to go round shooting cads like they were squirrels. The judge wouldn't accept that. And he couldn't go all out to plead his client guilty but insane. Mrs. William Thor wouldn't allow that. So he invented a new species of insanity. Dementia Americana, that uncontrollable rage which possesses every American male who learns that his marital bed has been violated. It was rather a holy madness, according to Mr. Delmas. It makes every home sacred. It makes a man believe that his wife is sacred. And it means that whoever stains the virtue of his wife has forfeited the protection of human laws and must look to the eternal justice and mercy of God. And, of course, it had the incalculable advantage that it was of very short duration. Once sated by the death of the beast, the dementia subsided, and the patient was calm and rational again, fit to take his place in society once more. There was no need for Harry Thor to be locked up in an insane asylum. Mr. Delmas saved his best efforts for his powerful and rhetorical summation. He had this difficult and irrational concept of the imaginary ailment to put over, allowing the jury to find his client guilty but insane at the time of the killing, or even if they accepted the undertone of unwritten law, not guilty of anything a decent man wouldn't do. And he had also to dispose of Evelyn's embarrassing affidavit, which the prosecution had dredged up. More intense emotional pleading was called for to explain this away, to confuse it with Mr. Thor's justified wrath as his suspicions of Stanford White grew, to remark that Evelyn denied the whole thing except as something the brutal White had forced her to put her name to as part of his dreadful schemes to implicate Mr. Thor. Actually, Delmas could have spared his breath to cool his porridge over the affidavit. The jury afterwards acknowledged that they didn't pay any attention to it whatsoever. Quite fortuitously, lawyer Abe Hummel, who drafted the document, lost his partner, William F. Howe, to the Grim Reaper that year, and the unsavoury law firm's amazing malfeasance was given quite an airing in the press. In fact, attention fastened on Hummel so securely that he was caught handing out bribes in a divorce action the following year, disbarred and imprisoned. So it happened that as soon as the jury in the Thor case heard Hummel's name, they simply disregarded all the testimony in any way connected with him, and I think they were very wise. For the rest, they were faced with the difficult decision whether Thor was mad as well as bad, guilty or seriously insane. Seven of them were convinced by Clinch's account of his conversation that he was quite sane. They wanted him found guilty. Four of them were sure he was mad. They wanted him not guilty. Two wavered, one wondering whether a manslaughter and insane compromise couldn't be reached. But it couldn't. After they spent two deeply uncomfortable nights sleeping on the bare floors and tables of the jury room, the judge accepted that they were deadlocked, and Harry Thor would have to be tried all over again for murder.